The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
One disclaimer, I'm going to do some really horrible things with the French language. I apologize in advance. I'm not a French speaker, so I'm going to do the best I can with the names. And once the question and answer, you know, you can take me to task for that when we get there. So I'm going to start off. How many of y'all know that right now Haiti is led by an unelected government? The people of Haiti's quest for democracy is pretty much gone on an unbroken line for the last 200 years. Right now, the U.S.-backed government of Haiti tried to force an election down the throats of the Haitian people. They responded with protests, riots, occupations, and they've successfully resisted it to the point. So right now, there's going to be an election scheduled in October. We'll see what happens. The U.S. spent $33 million to ensure the results they want, so the U.S. isn't going to give it up easily, as any empire has not given up easily. For an outside observer, it seems kind of strange why the U.S. and other countries have focused so much on Haiti. It's the poorest country in the Caribbean, poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. But it used to not be the case. The colony of Saint-Domingue used to be the richest, most prosperous colony in the Western Hemisphere. It was the most lucrative holding in the Americas, and three empires fought over it. As C.L.R. James famously wrote in The Black Jackmans, which I'll be using quite a bit in this talk, he said, "When history is written as it ought to be written, it is the moderation and long patience of the masses at which men will wonder, not their ferocity." And while that's true, the ruling class has none of that moderation and none of that none of that patience. And for the last 200 years, have been trying to reclaim what they lost. In fact, even 100 years after the revolution, when the League of Nations met, the Haitian delegates were berated by British delegates for their supposed massacre of the whites. So these things don't even get forgotten. Let's get into it. So the island of Hispaniola, as we call it now, was not discovered, but encountered. The Christopher Columbus in 1492 actually landed there. And we all know what a nice guy Christopher Columbus was. It was populated by the Taino people, and at the time, it's estimated there were either 500,000 to 750,000 natives of the island. Within 30 years, there were only 29,000 left. They were completely and totally decimated. James writes, "The Spaniards, the most advanced Europeans of their day, annexed the island, called it Hispaniola, and took the backward natives under their protection. They introduced Christianity, forced labor in mines, murder, rape, bloodhounds, and artificial famine by the destruction of cultivation to starve the rebellious. These and other requirements of the higher civilization reduced the native population from those numbers." But Spain quickly lost interest in the island. It was more interested in trying to find precious metals in South America, and the French, the English, and the Spanish fought over it for about 100 years until 1695, when the French won legal right to half the island, the west half, which we now know as Haiti. The west half, which the Spanish called the island Santo Domingo, the French called it Saint-Domingue, French version of it, was divided into three territories. There was the north, the west, and the south. Both were pretty sharply divided by mountain ranges, so they kind of had an autonomous region of their own. And on the eve of the revolution, La Cap was the biggest city. It was about the size of Boston of the time. And on the west, there's Port-au-Prince, which is the capital. And the here we go. On the eve of the revolution, the population was sharply divided. You had 30,000 whites that were planters on the island. 30,000 mixed race folks that C.L.R. James uses the term the racist term mulatto. I'm gonna try to use the term free colored or gens de couleur, which would be the French version of it. And there were 500,000 black slaves. So there were 90% of the population was held in slavery, and only 10%, of which half were white people. So there were four major divisions in society. You had the big whites, which were the plantation owners, often absentee landlords, because the climate was so dangerous and because for folks, they stayed in France, and many of them made up the revolutionary bourgeoisie that would make the French Revolution. About 15% of the National Assembly, when it convened, was made up of people that owned land in Saint-Domingue. Then there were the small whites, who were overseers, tradesmen, artisans, professionals. And they were deeply resentful of the big whites, but also deeply resentful of the slaves and the gens de couleur. And the colored people of Haiti, this wasn't lost on them, the division. They called the big whites the blanc blanc, the white whites, and the small whites the negro blanc, the black whites. So like the real test of race being if you can own property or not, or if you can own other people or not. The next division in society were the gens de couleur. They were the property owners of mixed heritage, and they formed the sort of intermediate class in the society. Though they often had the same economic interests as the big whites because they owned large plantations and they also owned slaves, the big whites denied them full citizenship, hated them, persecuted them, oppressed them. But that only occurred in the mid-1700s. Before then, they had full and equal citizenship rights, and laws started changing, some of them quite absurd. In 1773, they couldn't take the names of white relatives, and they couldn't wear European dress, you know, whatever that means. And as the 18th century moved on, there was a massive like categorization system that like could somehow reduce how much white and how much black was in your blood. So there's 128 different types of mixed race people. But even though they were persecuted, the colony depended on them as a police and military force. The gens de couleur had to serve in the police force, the Marechaussee. That I know I'm pronouncing wrong. And they had to serve in the army, but they couldn't hold officer positions. And in fact, during the American Revolution, some of the gens de couleur served and fought against the British and fought in the Battle of Savannah. Someone that I'll bring up later, André Rigaud, probably fought in the Battle of Savannah. And the Republican ideas and ideals certainly had some influence on them. The dilemma for the gens de couleur is that while the big whites depended on them, if they gave full citizenship rights to them, it undermines ideologically the whole slave system. Because if there are people of color that are equal to you, then why should other people be held as slaves? So there's a tension there, and that tension will explode during the revolution. And finally, the slaves, which make up 90% of the people on the island. Initially, the French brought white laborers along with black laborers. Engagé was the term. It was basically the same thing as the indentured servitude in the Americas. And they would work for a period of 3 years and then be free. Most of them didn't make it to 3 years. They died, at work to death or from disease. But the problem with that is once they're free, these white laborers would then demand land rights and form, you know, what the same problem the small whites formed for the big whites. So over the course of the century, the French imported more and more African slaves. And what they mostly, what they cultivated was sugar, coffee, indigo, and a few other things. Sugar is one of the worst, hardest labor demanding cultivations possible. The 50% of the African slaves would die within the 5 years of arrival. 20% would die from on the journey from Africa. Many of them bravely jumping off the ships rather than live their lives in slavery. And so by the time of the revolution, by the time of 1789, two-thirds of the slaves of Saint-Domingue were estimated to be of African birth. And they kept those cultural ties, those language ties, and those religious ties. And it would play a very big role in networking and planning the revolution. But they had to keep importing more and more slaves. And by 1789, they were to import about 40,000 a year, just an obscene amount. To give some context, there were 500,000 slaves in Saint-Domingue. At the time, there were 700,000 in all of America. So quite a bit. Cultivating sugar cane was extremely dangerous. You would get cuts from the sugar cane. You had to work 14 to 16 hour days in the harsh heat. It required bringing together hundreds and hundreds of laborers together. And it had to be processed quite quickly once it was harvested at sugar mills, or else the sugar goes bad. So C.L.R. James calls it one of the most industrialized workforces at the time. Here's a quote of him talking about the slaves. "The slaves worked on the land, and like revolutionary peasants everywhere, they aimed at the extermination of their oppressors." It's not bad. But working and living together in gangs of hundreds on the huge sugar factories which covered the northern plain, they were closer to a modern proletariat than any group of workers in existence at the time." So he's trying to say something about the potential that we see in the modern proletariat was certainly there in Saint-Domingue. But it wasn't just there were also divisions within the slave population, and there were slave drivers who were the sort of the more privileged level of the slaves, and they would quite literally drive the work, and they would use whippings when whippings would happen. But interestingly enough, you would think that this layer of folks would be the most conservative. They ended up being the leaders of the revolution when it happened, which is quite would be surprising. And then there were domestic slaves and slaves that would tend to animals, artisans, and elsewhere. Toussaint Louverture was he tended to the horses on his plantation. Now the French government had ostensible laws to outline rights for the slaves. They had the Code Noir, the black code, but this was mostly ignored. It gave certain rights to slaves to petition authorities on grievances, which surprises me. It enforces a certain amount of nutrition to the slaves, and the slave owners got around that by instead of feeding the slaves as much as required, they let the slaves tend their own tiny piece of land. So on the day and a half they got off a week, they had to just tend their own land to supplement their food. So they pretty much never had any time off. But because of the ratio of owners to slaves, there was a relative freedom of movement. On Sundays, slaves often went to the city to sell some of the goods that they grew on their own plot. And they would take part in religious ceremonies and different gatherings. The slave owners tried their best to stop this from happening, but just by virtue of the system, they really couldn't. And the slaves resisted, and they resisted quite fiercely, from the boats to the revolution. The two forms that it mostly took was marronage and poison. So marronage was how the slaves they would escape and join armed bands out in the mountains. They would call them maroon bands, and it wasn't. This was somewhat tolerated in the short term. If you left for a few days and came back, you could negotiate some sort of agreement. And sometimes it took the form of strikes, where entire workforces on plantations would leave and then negotiate with their owners, like, oh no, we actually want this sort of hours, we want this sort of working conditions, we want this overseer fired, and that would happen. So it's quite interesting, and then poison, and poison was a fear of all the owners there. Slaves would kill slave owners' children. They would kill the slave owners. They would kill overseers, and they would kill themselves and induce their own abortions rather than give birth to more folks that would be put into forced slavery. The biggest uprisings before the revolution in 1791 was a man named Macandal, and he became like a myth for the rest of the slaves and for the owners. He had organized a plan to poison all the main water sources in the cities, and he wanted to kill all the whites in one fell swoop and take power. He almost did it, and he got betrayed and executed. But before he was executed, he told his followers, he says, when they try to kill me, I'm going to turn into a fly and fly away. So the belief that he was still around to come back stayed real strongly with people. All right. And before, when I talked about the Code Noir that gave rights to slaves to petition for grievances, that actually was enacted a few times. And it formed really interesting contradictory situations. There was one case in 1788 on the eve of the revolution for an owner named Lejeune. And he was paranoid that some of his slaves were poisoning his other slaves. And he tortured two women and held them in captivity. 14 of his slaves went to Le Cap and charged him. And the judges took the case. And naturally, the whites exploded in anger and attacked, and the governor of Saint-Domingue at the time said, to put it shortly, it seems that the safety of the colony depends on the acquittal of Lejeune. So they acquitted Lejeune. There's some parallels, I think, with cops nowadays. I won't say too much. In France at the time, there wasn't the same sort of abolition movement that you would see in the Americas or in Britain at the time. But right in 1788, there was a society named the Société des Amis des Negros, the Friends of the Blacks, and it was led by a few folks that you'll hear more about in the French Revolution: Brousseau, Condorcet, the Marquis de Lafayette, the Comte de Mirabeau. And they were for abolition, but gradually, a slow transition. And really, they didn't have much influence until the revolution, but they were big boogeymen for the planters. The planters wanted to blame everything on them. And the planters formed their own counter society called the Club Massaillac, which was their own kind of a pressure group on the government. So 1789 happens. The revolution begins in France. And the National Assembly convenes, and at the time, delegates from Saint-Domingue came and wished to be seated, and it formed a real controversy. It's like, well, you know, how do you apportion delegates? What is it, you know, the same situation that occurs in the U.S. And the Mirabeau, who was with the friends of the Blacks, said, the free blacks are proprietors and taxpayers, and yet they have not been allowed to vote. And as for the slaves, either they are men or they are not. If the colonists consider them men, let them free them and make them eligible for seats. So, you know, pointing out the real discrepancy, the National Assembly kind of tables the discussion and makes a compromise. They say, you get six delegates, two for each province. We're not going to talk about too much more. And the planters in France don't take the revolution very well. They write, people here are drunk with liberty. The peril is great. They try to blockade all writings coming to Saint-Domingue that have the word liberty in them. And the Declaration of the Rights of Man is incredibly dangerous for them. It begins with men are born and remain equal in rights. It's like, ooh, you know, what are we gonna do about that? But nevertheless, the revolution kind of happens in parallel in Saint-Domingue. The little whites see an opportunity to increase their stature, and the big whites see an opportunity to open up trade and to rule their own island. In fact, the first movements for independence in Saint-Domingue are from the big whites. You know, they have an exclusive monopoly of trade with France. This is not capitalism we're talking about at the time. You know, and Saint-Domingue exists only for the betterment of France. So the big whites are stuck in this bind where they can only trade with France, and they want to trade with anyone else they want. So this is an opportunity for them. They form their own colonial assemblies, and they arm themselves, and there's skirmishes. But at the same time, the free coloreds in Saint-Domingue see an opportunity for them to press for their rights. And we start seeing small civil wars occur. And at the time, the free colored send a delegation to France, to Paris. Julien Raymond, who I'll mention much more, and Vincent Auger are a special commission that come to Paris 21 minutes. Oh, wow, I gotta hurry up. To petition for their rights. They go to the National Assembly and they get kind of turned down. It's again sort of tabled. So Auger leaves, goes to the US, gets a bunch of guns, and goes back to Saint-Domingue, and he starts trying to arm him and the other jeunes de couleur to fight for their rights. He doesn't, at the time, give any thought to arming slaves. And he rises with a few hundred of his own men, and he gets absolutely crushed. He's captured, and he's tortured. He's broken on the wheel in the public square, and then beheaded. And even in death, even in execution, it's segregated. There's a special spot for execution for whites, and there's a special spot for execution for blacks. And this is really starts moving things along in Saint-Domingue. So in August of 1791, the slaves themselves start plotting an uprising. It's led by a slave driver who was, you know, just under the overseer, named Boukman, and he was also a Vodou priest. They planned through dozens of delegates from different plantations got together at night in these nighttime planning missions. And they rose in a coordinated fashion all over the North. In fact, it could have been even better. There were plans to have slaves rise up in La Cap as well, but that kind of got disjointed. And to just give an example of the scope of this, in the first 8 days, 184 plantations burned. Within the first month, 1,200 coffee plantations were destroyed. Within a few weeks, there were 10,000African slaves that were fighting, and they fought in a way that the French weren't familiar with, guerrilla tactics. And here's one quote from a French soldier at the time said, "Following their cowardly custom, they were hidden and fired on us." Who knew? You know, and. The brutality that you know the whites would complain about was likely very much overstated. There was one slave leader named Jeannot that was quite brutal and would execute prisoners, and he was given a military trial by another of the rising slaves and shot for torturing and killing whites. So At the time, the main leaders now were Biasso and Jean-Francois, who were both leaders of the group. And you'll notice I haven't spoken much about Toussaint Louverture yet. He, at the time, he waited about a month into the insurrection to join it himself. And Toussaint is a very, very interesting, you know, person. He was born Toussaint Breda, and he was born a slave, but as I said, he was slightly privileged, which is almost an absurd term to use for slaves. But he tended to the animals, and he was given some education. His father was a chief from when he was captured, and he learned how to speak French and read and write. And he eventually bought his own freedom before the revolution, and he owned his own land and was a slave owner before the revolution, which is quite. You know, contradictory. But within a couple months, he joined the revolution itself, and became one of the highest ranking lieutenants. But by late November of 1791, the insurrection started running out of steam a little bit, and Jean-Francois and Biasso went to try to negotiate with the assembly in Le Cap, and they were turned down. The deal, they're saying, listen, we just want amnesty for rising. We'll bring people back to the plantations, and just the officers are going to get freedom. They get turned down, and the white San Domingue, they're never going to get a good deal like that again. It was all downhill for them. Now, at this time, things start moving more and more in Paris, and what C.L.R. James keeps trying to show is how at every moment the masses sort of interject themselves and move the history forward. So the at this point the bourgeoisie is pretty happy with what they've accomplished. They have their individual rights. They've abolished feudalism, but the masses show up on the scene again, and they declare a republic, right? And and execute the king. And at this point, the British and the Spanish declare war on Saint-Domingue. And this imperial war will give the opening for the slaves to really win their freedom. At this point, the Republicans are in charge in France, and they send a new commission to take charge in Saint-Domingue. Two folks called Sontenax and Pulvereux will come. There'll be a third, but he gets to Saint-Domingue and he runs away because he's terrified of what's going on. And Sontenax and Pulvereux, they're both members of the Friends of the Blacks. They're both abolitionists, but they come to put down the slave revolution. And in doing this, they ally with the free coloreds, and they grant full rights to the free coloreds. But they find that they're in an untenable situation. The whites, no matter what, don't back them, and now you have a war where the British and the Spanish are both trying to invade and take control of the colony. So the Sontenax and Pulvereux end up having to arm slaves to save themselves and save the colony. Initially, it's, you know, if you fight for us, we'll give you freedom. And then pushed, they declare a general amnesty, or a general abolition, emancipation to the slaves. They do this without the backing of France initially. This is when Toussaint Louverture really comes on the scene. At the time, he had been fighting for Spain, because Spain, in order to entice people to fight for him, would also give conditional freedom. Toussaint switches sides, starts pushing back, and just absolutely destroys the Spanish. And then, as news makes it back to France, the revolution's at its highest point. Robespierre and the Mountain are in charge. The masses are at their highest level of power, and they proclaim an emancipation for all the colonies in France. There's no longer slavery in the French Republic. And at the time, there's a delegation from Saint-Domingue of a white man, a free colored man, and a black man, and they all get stirring applause. It's a pretty amazing moment. So Toussaint Louverture quickly becomes the second most powerful man in Saint-Domingue. And him being a black brigadier general brings quite a bit of legitimacy, and he starts bringing lots of blacks to join his side. And he's quite, I mean, his l'ouverture means the opening. He finds an opening everywhere, you know, and he starts trying to win people over. In one scenario, he's trying to win over 5,000 soldiers of Duodene, who was fighting for the Spanish. He writes to him, "I cannot believe the painful rumors that are spread about you, that you have abandoned your country to ally yourself with the English, sworn enemies of our liberty and equality. For a time, the Spaniards had blinded my eyes, but I did not take long to recognize their rascality. I abandoned them and beaten them well. I returned to my country, which received me with open arms and has recompensed my service as well. I beg of you, my dear brother, to follow my example." So he had envoys read that to the camps, and Duodene didn't take it, but his soldiers overthrew him, went to his side, and joined Toussaint. And at the time, there's a really, I mean, all of the abstract principles that are being discussed in France is happening with real stakes in Saint-Domingue. So Jean-Francois, who was Toussaint's superior before he joined the French, stays with the Spanish, and he says, "Well, you know, the liberty that the Republicans tell you about is false, because only a king can proclaim freedom, because he has authority from God, right? But Toussaint counters, and he says, "We are Republicans, and therefore free by natural laws. Only kings would dare give themselves the right to reduce to slavery men who are naturally free. Republicans cannot come to agreement with a king. Let him come, and you with him. We are ready to receive you in the manner of Republicans." Which is, you know, I really appreciated Republicanism reading that. It's a really powerful idea, you know. So, but at this point, things start taking a turn in Paris, and Robespierre and the Mountain are overthrown. There's counter-revolution. And at this point, the planters in Paris start plotting to bring back slavery. And the commissions that come to Saint-Domingue get more and more conservative. Toussaint ends up is forced to fight a civil war with the Free Colors in the South. And it is quite devastating. And shortly, Bonaparte takes power. And Napoleon Bonaparte is really, you can read from his writings, a vicious racist, you know, and he had no interest in giving Toussaint and the blacks freedom. But he gives Toussaint, there's a little, you know, he recognizes him, but he starts plotting immediately to reinstate slavery. And Toussaint, you know, eventually becomes the most powerful man in Saint-Domingue, is caught in quite a bind. Though slavery is abolished, the freedom is kind of limited, and you'll see a lot of parallels with the post-emancipation in the United States. Saint-Domingue's value to France is in its exports and its sugar. And free people don't cultivate sugar very well because it's so horrible. You know, you don't want to do it. You know, so Toussaint, while you know giving full rights and freedom to the cultivators, also has to put in military discipline to enforce people to stay on their plantations to keep working. But they're paid a wage, and you know, and they can chain, you know, they can leave and go to a different plantation if they want to, and anyone can serve in any government office as they can. But as things start moving backwards in France, Toussaint, you know, encounters troubles, you know, in trying to keep his republic together. Moïse, his adopted nephew and a general, rises with blacks in the north, and they're trying to fight back against the military discipline of Toussaint. And Toussaint crushes the revolt and executes his nephew. You know, C.L.R. James says he cuts off the branch that he was sitting on at that moment. Yep. You know, he was walking a very delicate line, and he loses the trust of a lot of the inhabitants of the island at this point. And in a couple years, the French reinvade. Napoleon's brother-in-law, Leclerc, comes and brings with him thousands of troops. And initially, they know that we can't, that they can't just reinstitute slavery, but they say, well, we're going to come bring special laws, you know, quote unquote. We don't, you know, on all but name, they're saying they're going to reinstitute slavery and depose everyone there. Louverture wasn't stupid, and he planned ahead for it. One of the letters he writes to his lieutenant at the time, Dessalines, he writes, "Do not forget, while waiting for the rainy season, which will rid of us of our foes, that we have no other resource than destruction and fire. Bear in mind that the soil bathed with our sweat must not furnish our enemies with the smallest sustenance. Tear up the roads with shot. Throw corpses and horses into all the fountains. Burn and annihilate everything, in order that those who have come to reduce us to slavery may have before their eyes the image of the hell that they deserve." Pretty powerful stuff. So the French invade, but Toussaint's vacillations and his betrayals here and there sort of undermine his authority. And though they put up a really heroic fight, at one point Dessalines defends the fort of Crete-à-Pierrot. And in the defense of it, the French besiege it, and at night they hear the Marseillaise, the French revolutionary songs singing from the black soldiers inside, and they start wondering, like, are we on the right side? You know? But some of Toussaint's generals surrender and switch sides, and Toussaint is later forced to surrender, and he's captured. And as he's captured, he says his famous phrase, if I can find it. Yeah, here we go. "In overthrowing me, you have cut down in San Domingo only the trunk of the Tree of Liberty. It will spring up again by the roots, for they are numerous and deep." And he shipped off to the mountains of France to die. But at this time, just as in France, the masses again push themselves into history. The cultivators, men and women, all rise up. And for a time, the Toussaint's lieutenants, Dessalines and Henri Christophe and a few other folks, fight against their own people. But they're already plotting their turn against the French. And as the rainy season comes, as Toussaint predicted, the French troops start dying like flies. Dessalines turns on the French, and it becomes like a vicious war as C.L.R. James says, it was a war not so much of armies, but as of the people. It was now a war with the racial divisions emphasizing the class struggle, blacks and free coloreds against whites. So the French brought almost an extermination plan. They knew that they couldn't bring back the reins of slavery. They would have to kill most of the people of Saint-Domingue and bring new laborers over. So the race war was brought to them, and they responded. And they drive them off. The French end up suffering 50,000 dead. And Dessalines declares independence for now Haiti, as the Taino people from the very beginning, they called it Haiti, was the island's name. And they drove them off. And Haiti would remain an inspiration for slaves and abolitionists throughout the world. Sontenac's Emancipation Decree would be reprinted in 1861 by American abolitionists. Frederick Douglass said Haiti struck for the freedom of every black man in the world. I mean, he ended up being the ambassador to Haiti in the 1890s. But Haiti would suffer great revenge from the imperial powers. Initially, they were just ignored and isolated. And in 1825, the French paid them, forced them to pay an indemnity to literally pay for their rights to be free. They had to pay back for the lost property, right? But the symbol and the what it meant for people around the world was not lost. And C.L.R. James writes this in 1938, knowing that the anti-colonial struggles in Africa were to come, you know, and he's trying to lend lessons and history for people. And C.L.R., he near the end of the book, he writes, the imperialists envisage an eternity of African exploitation. They dream dreams.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.